From RunAsRadio.com, you're listening to Run As Radio, the internet audio talk show for IT professionals with Richard Campbell and Greg Hughes. This is Brandon Wen announcing show number 245 with guest Dana Epp, recorded Friday, December 23rd, 2011. Run As Radio is produced each week by Pwop Productions, providing professional media and podcasting services online at pwop.com. You can follow the boys on Twitter at twitter.com/runasradio.
Thank you, Brandon. This is Run As Radio. I'm your host, Richard Campbell. Here with me today is Dana Epp, and just a happy 2012 to you, my friend.
Well, thank you very much.
And good to have you back on the show. I think you're my most frequent guest these days, or over the years, actually, looking back. We've been doing this show now for 5 years, so.
Wow. It's been that long, hasn't
it? It's been that long already.
Well, when you're awesome, you can do lots of shows, right?
Well, you just keep going.
Yeah, well, you're good at your stuff.
And for those who don't know Dana Epp, he's Scorpion Software's founder and CEO, and all about software security and dealing with the convergence of information security principles and practices with digital information asset protection. Mm-hmm. And the author of a couple of really cool tools, as I recall, as well.
Oh, yeah. Oh, we're always building stuff.
So what have you been thinking about, my friend? Where are you focused on these days?
You know, it's funny, I'm still, you know, over at Scorpion Software, you know, we're still solving the obvious problems with passwords that others ignore. But, you know, it's been kind of interesting over the last couple of years as we've been talking with a lot of our customers and the community at large as, you know, I go and travel so much. And it's all about the aspect of people are always thinking that they can solve security problems with products. And so they think that,
right,
you know, that's the whole way it works. And it's not. It's, you know, security is really a process. And in the end, what's interesting is that we see is that there are lots of IT service providers and IT professionals who think, I will solve this problem by buying X, and X is some whiz-bang thing that the vendor has told them will solve everything and make them coffee too, right? And it's just, it doesn't work that way. But what's interesting is that people are starting to realize something that I actually knew, you know, I don't know, I probably back in 2003, I read a really, really good book by a friend of mine called Inside the Security Mind by Kevin Day.
Oh, yeah.
And the book was really, really cool because it really summed up something that I have known for years that just hasn't really been bubbled up and hasn't been explained very well, which was, if we know that security is a process and not a product, and we know that ultimately the decisions that we make have impacts that can be far-reaching from a safeguard decision, we start realizing at the end of the day that we can design safer systems and we could be more resilient in the midst of failure by just making some decisions that are more process-based than product-based, right? And so when what we're talking about there ultimately is a lot of people ask me as a security MVP, you know, what do I need to buy or what do I need to get, especially
nice.
In this day and age? And I think that's a bad question to ask. Actually, it's the wrong question to ask. The question is, you know, when they say, well, we need this to be ultimately secure. There is no such thing as ultimate. Absolute security is a myth. With
mm-hmm.
enough money and motive, anything can be breached.
Sure.
And because the human factor is always the weakest link here, in the end, what we got to do is just put in enough security to reduce the risk to an acceptable level. And so when we start thinking about that in a different tone and in a different way, what we start doing is realizing we can make simple decisions that cost us nothing. They really don't. It's just a matter of spending, there's some time involved, there's an investment involved. But ultimately, we can make decisions of a higher security mindset that will allow us to be more defendable or more defensible. Let me give you some examples of last decade of things that have occurred. Let's talk of things like SQL Slammer.
Right.
Here's a perfect example of a worm that propagated so efficiently and so effectively because everyone and their dog had MSDE, because every software developer used that as their data store, and no one patched it, and it was a big risk. And when people ask me about that, when that happened, and they had SQL Server, and it would get, you know, infected, and, you know, it was propagating through, what was funny was we didn't get hit by that. And the reason we didn't get hit by that was, actually, we did get hit by that, but it had almost zero effect.
Hmm.
It couldn't propagate. Why? We had a very simple policy in the office. Don't allow SQL propagation across devices except for the ones that actually had SQL.
Right.
And only do that between SQL that were doing replication. So ultimately, when it infected onto our network, it moved nowhere. There was nowhere to go.
Right.
And then even on our firewall, we didn't allow outbound SQL because there was never, ever a need to.
Yeah.
So by having these explicit rules, very simple, it's just don't allow anything except what we allow based off of our understanding of how our network functions. Now, that's a pretty lofty goal to do that at any size business. You know, we're a small business, less than 50 employees. So, you know, in the end, it's a little harder for us. We don't have dedicated IT security staff whose job function is to just set up policies and manage that. But ultimately, it was like, well, no, we know how our software company works. We know what we need to do. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, we set up our policies to do that. So we didn't get hit. But how many businesses did?
Well, most people are stuck with the defaults, right? They don't actually adjust. And I'm looking at your 8 rules of security here, and you're really talking about least privilege, that you only allow what you're supposed to do, which actually means thinking through what machines are supposed to connect to each other.
That's right. Yeah. And what you're referring to is, like, back in 2003, I wrote this blog post called The 8 Rules of Information Security. And it was this aspect about, it was really stuff that I had already known for, but I've never bubbled it down. And after reading Kevin Day's book, I was like, oh, okay, I get it. Yes, this is how we really need to define it. There are really 8 rules that if you affect that and actually think about each one of them and apply that to your business, and not just to the business itself, as if people are software developers, they can apply the same thing inside their applications. It's slightly shifted and changed, but things like the rule of least privilege, which is like rule number one, that takes precedence over everything else. The reality is that the best security system in the world will be the one thing that will allow you to do everything in the network that you're allowed to do.
Right.
The only time you'll ever see least privilege really come to bear is when you do something you're not supposed to do. So let's put that into verbiage that makes sense this day and age for people on desktops. UAC.
Mm-hmm.
This aspect of when you go to do something that you're not supposed to, it's going to prompt you. Now, in itself, UAC is not a security boundary. We could go and have an entire discussion about that.
Right.
But the reality is that it's this aspect of saying, when you go to do something that requires higher privilege, you need to be aware what that is. And that's why when UAC pops up, it's because you're doing something that you're not supposed to be doing by permission. Now, it may be that you need to do it or you need to affect something. And so that's a decision that you can cognitively say, yeah, okay, I'm okay with that. But in many cases, it's, well, no, this software is written poorly and it's writing to places it's not supposed to. And that's this idea about least privilege. It's like, let's just take all the privilege away except what you need to do your job. And if you actually affect that in the network, now all of a sudden risks start to get reduced significantly. Because why should the CFO have access to the source control of a software company? Why should the CTO have access to the actual data inside the SQL database? They shouldn't have this kind of stuff.
Right.
And you can affect these change by policy decisions, security decisions. They don't cost anything except time and then the time to document it efficiently and effectively so that there's no surprises.
Well, now you start talking about tools, because once you're trying to implement the rule of least privilege, there are tools that help you do that, that help track what privileges are actually out there, how you actually can alter them. You know, that tools come after the goal.
That's right. Well, there's actually, if you look about it, there's a 3-stage process on how information security really should be affected.
Mm-hmm.
It starts by people, because number one, people drive everything, decisions, and ultimately they're the biggest risk. But then you have process, and process is what's being driven to allow the people to do their jobs and allow them to affect what needs to be accomplished. And then finally, that third thing is product. And product's the bottom of the stack for a reason, because it's used as a safeguard to affect the change or whatever is needed based on your policy decisions.
Right.
So if you say, I want to allow X, then you should say, okay, and what would be the safeguard to properly affect that? Or, you know, when we talk about part of what you're trying to accomplish at the end, there's one of the rules was this aspect of rule of separation. It's like, well, if we need someone to do a certain job function, we can allow them to do one thing, but then we make sure we can separate that and mitigate the risk so that maybe in the way we're affecting it, they don't need to see everything or all parts of that, right?
Mm-hmm.
And ultimately, that allows businesses to allow them to get the job done they need to, and the safeguards are helping to associate that. When I think normal nomenclature for this kind of stuff on networks, it's the simplicity of a VLAN. If you have a managed switch and you know that no one should be accessing the HR systems except for HR personnel,
right,
you can affect some of this by making safeguard decisions, which may be, hey, maybe I'm going to trunk that off to the VLAN so the only thing I can access that are these ports, or maybe it's something like, well, we don't even need to do this at the network level. We can do this higher up the stack by affecting, you know, SDI, server and domain isolation policies, or maybe we'll just do an IPsec policy that says only this user who is in the role of HR management.
But now you're pushing on the real challenge, which is, if I implement this at the virtual network level and possibly at the domain level, when I do need to create a new permission and get somebody through to something, okay, this guy over here in payroll needs access to HR data, trying to figure out why he can't get there becomes quite challenging.
It can very well. One of the things to think about when you're dealing this, and this is something we do here, is that we're a window shop, so we, you know, we affect a lot through Active Directory, and we do role-based security based off of security group membership decisions. Mm-hmm. And then our safeguard decisions at the end, after we've decided what our policies are. So we have a document. We have two sets of documents here in the organization. We actually use a SharePoint wiki here that's a living, breathing document. And that allows us to affect change and modify for part of our change management. We have a whole history tracking of what the security policy decisions are and what that authorization rights are. And we don't hide that. Everyone knows who's responsible for what and what they have access to. But what's really interesting about that is that it allows us then to go and take a look and say, all right, we don't want this to be based off of people. Because that's the worst decision you can actually make, because now you're running around and affecting ACL decisions, you're affecting firewall policy decisions, mm-hmm. you're affecting even group policy decisions by the guy's name, and that's not the way to do it. The better way is to figure out what the role is. If someone has to be responsible for accessing HR systems, in our case, we have it role_HR.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if we have someone that needs access to payroll, which is a part of accounting, but it's also part of HR, we actually have role_payroll, and that gives access to different sets. So
sure.
then when we apply safeguards, we can say, oh, we need it. So now when someone comes and says, well, this person does need it, but we don't, you know, we need to make a decision on what they're allowed to see. We don't have to do that because we have a documented chart that actually states out, we have what's called an asset category list, which is basically every part of digital and physical assets that we have in relations to the job function or role. And then we map that up to the security decisions that we want to accomplish. So when we go and put them in that security group in Active Directory, it affects it in the right locations. If we decide we need to make a modification, it is a bigger thing than, oh, Joe needs access to here. It's the role that Joel's doing is supposed to have this kind of permissions. We need to decide on there.
Mm-hmm.
So what happens, though, if we don't know that? If we don't know we can't access it and it's just frustrating us? Well, actually, security logs in Windows is extremely loud. There's a lot of audit records on there. If you know how to read them, they can really, really help you. Now, there's lots of tools out there that you can use that can massage those logs and review them and build them, so that can help you.
Because they are quite noisy. There's a lot of stuff in those logs.
That's right. But that's why what you got to do is, there's another blog post I wrote back in 2004 about Tune for Silence. What it is that once you're good at knowing how your network functions and what's going on there, you tune so your anomaly detection systems or if you have intrusion detection sensors and whatever you're using for monitoring this, we use a couple of host-based intrusion prevention systems. One of the things that we do is we know what the expected normal behaviors are, and we then can use human heuristics to look at the things that are different. So that takes a lot of time to tune because you got to say, okay, this is just normal stuff we know. We can ignore this type of decisions, but we still need to review this on a monthly basis just in case. But ultimately, then what we can do is we tune all that really, really big, noisy stuff out because we don't care when someone's TS grindering us and they're rattling at the doors. We know what's going on there. And we've affected two-factor authentication on all those servers. So, you know, we have another higher level of trust because we know that they're proving their identity when they're accessing the systems. But ultimately, when everything's said and done, we know that because we do it by policy, we're saying you have to be in this role to affect these changes, and we've already dealt with all that plumbing, we've been able to handle that. And so what ends up happening is it's not so difficult. It's difficult the first time you do it, right, because it takes time.
Mm-hmm.
But once it's done and then you've tuned the logs for silence, so you're only looking for things that are alerting that are really bubbling up, and you've set up these rules and you know what needs to be accomplished there, the eight rules of information security, there's like, you know, we're talking about rule of least privilege, but there's a whole bunch of other things like change management,
mm-hmm.
and the whole aspect about trust, right? You know, when I think of this world, this day and age, how much trust we give to IT people that are usually the least paid people in an organization.
Yes, and not very well respected either. They can mess
no.
with your world in ways you can't imagine.
That's right. You know, it's funny. It's like, if I'm sure you've probably read it, but the Bastard Operator from Hell.
Oh, yes.
The Archives Assignment is just so hilarious. but what's funny, what people don't realize, is that actually has a vein of truth in it.
Yeah, that's why it's funny.
That's why it's so funny. But business owners and C-level executives don't get it. You know, they look at IT as either a tool or a pain, right? It all depends on where they see it on their balance sheet. The businesses that really flourish and are very successful, they treat IT as an asset to the business, and they understand the investments need to be there. But that's actually not the norm. A lot of times, especially in the SMB space, They just look at that as a cost center and they hate it. It's a necessary evil. And so those IT people are not people they love, right? They loathe them. Now, the good IT service providers that we work with a lot of, these guys get it. They know how to talk, instead of having the higher security mind, it's about having the higher IT mind. Mm-hmm. It's not about talking IT gibberish to business owners. It's about helping them to understand how they can leverage IT to get more out of their systems, to make more money. And ultimately, then IT people are, they're now looked upon as, you know, those really trusted advisors giving them real advice that matters. Not you need this whiz bang thing. It's, well, you have this problem, Mr. Customer, and that problem seems to be related to these processes you have. You know what we could do is we could affect change by doing this, and by buying these tools, we could help you to be better.
Well, Nate, this steps into your rule of weakest link, that part of the challenge here is not just selling the given tool, but recognizing all the elements, because the weakest link is the thing that'll get exploited.
That's right. And that's, and you know what's funny is I use an analogy on that post, something to the effect of, you can go and buy like a $20,000 solid oak door in your house,
right,
at the front. But if your back door is like a screen door,
yeah,
your effective security of your house is that $100 screen door. It's
sure.
not the $20,000 one at the front. And not a lot of people know that or think about that. They're just thinking, oh, I was told I have to buy this whiz-bang device and that's going to help me. It's like, but there's a bigger, you need to look at the attack surface of the entire organization, from everything from, you know, access entry points and that, to people. Like, you know, here at our office, we actually, it's kind of funny, we made some decisions last year, you know, in 2011, that we moved from all our salespeople, because we're going through a big growth curve here, and we're bringing on a whole bunch of new salespeople, and we're looking, going, well, we're buying like 20 new computers for all these salespeople, and the cost of that's X, and you know, Microsoft has this technology called multi-point server, which is basically this terminal server on steroids. And what was interesting about it is we started looking at it and saying, okay, well, if we have to put 20 new boxes on the network, and we have to buy all those boxes, and we got to lock them down, we got to deal with patch management processes, we have to deal with, you know, the Adobe hell, which is just, you know, every 3 days there's new updates. And it's like, do I really want to be affecting that on 20 salespeople's machines, or do I want to sit there and actually do it on two servers and affect the change for 10 people per server, right?
Mm-hmm.
And what was interesting when we started talking about this whole aspect of, you know, when I look at the information security rules and practices we have here, it was like, well, actually, we could actually lock everything down in a single way. So what we do is we went out and we bought these thin clients that cost us almost nothing, and then we just set up a firewall rule that says don't allow anything to these thin clients, and don't allow anything except outbound to the multipoint server,
right,
and then set it up with an IPsec policy, because they're running these thin clients are running Windows 7 embedded, so we could actually have an IPsec security policy, so we don't have to worry about VLANs and stuff, because we have a secure end-to-end encryption all the way to the multipoint box,
mm-hmm.
And boom, now we just need to affect security decisions on that one server. And what ends up happening is that it's more efficient, more effective, and guess what? It actually reduced our per-employee technical cost for machines by almost 50%. And so what ends up happening is I got much more cost-effective decisions from a money-wise, good for my VP ops and finance, you know, who I don't want them yelling at me for spending money left, right, and center. But on the same line, I made better security decisions, because now I can affect policy decisions in one place. Management is at one place. Simplicity of controlling everything is at one place.
And your total cost of ownership is lower, too. These are easier to maintain, you know. But it's interesting how the hardware has evolved, that we're going into more and more of this shared scenario. This used to be harder to do, but we did a show with Multipoint a couple of 3 months ago. And if you haven't listened to it, I got to recommend it, just because folks don't know about this product. It's really the maturation of terminal services and Citrix and the like into something that's very cost effective and sensible.
Oh, yeah. And when you talk about with Windows Server 2008 R2 and having the effect of remote FX capabilities for video and you know, they're going, you know, I'm actually looking forward to where it goes. And we'll probably have to have a conversation in the next year over it, because I know that as they mature the next version of that, there are going to be some huge improvements in perf and that. It's kind of interesting because Multipoint comes out from the educational space. And it comes because at the time it was, hey, we can put this in effect so students could all work together on a single machine and do all that. But it was funny when the way we do it, because we roll it out, we have two Hyper-V servers, we have two Hyper-V servers here, and one of them runs Multipoint on there and virtualized. That's for all our sales staff, because they just needed to have Office 2010. They needed to have access to a browser because we have single sign-on capabilities with one of our products that gives them access to Salesforce data and gives them access to all the internal applications we have, so they don't even need to worry about passwords once they log in. And then we have another one, which is for our customer service and QA team, and that's a physical multi-point box. And the reason for that is it actually runs Hyper-V inside it. And the reason for that is we use ASMAN, Authorization Manager, to control a set of VMs. So customer service can spin up when they're talking with customers to see and affect how does our software work in these scenarios. And then our QA guys, they're building new VMs and testing out against new scenarios all the time. So all of a sudden, we're leveraging all of this Microsoft stack in a very, very interesting way. And ultimately, we've got two boxes, and we're affecting and the ability to run about 40 employees off of those things.
Nice.
And that's pretty good, efficient way of doing things. But when we go back and think about it from the eight rules of information security, what we're talking about is what I did was, okay, let's affect the rule of least privilege so that we're controlling what they can access. Nobody has administrative rights on these boxes. They have, we're using least privilege on what they're authorized to see, do, and act. We have change management control much more efficiently because we're sitting on there and only affecting the change management on like two boxes instead of 20, which is very, very effective for us because we're not spending all day dealing with patch management and change management on applications that need to get asked because we use AppLocker to lock down the apps on multipoint, so it kind of controls that. Rule of trust, because now what we've done is the reason we have sales on one multipoint box and QA and customer service on another is about the rule of trust. We don't want salespeople to see the work that we're doing on for future versions and whatnot.
Right, it distracts them.
Right? Don't want salespeople out there talking about stuff until it's ready, right?
Yeah.
Not that we don't trust them, but it's there.
It's a distraction. You want them selling what you've got ready to sell, not what you're going to have ready in a year.
That's right.
This section of Run As Radio is sponsored by Secret Server, the password management software for IT admins. Secret Server helps you manage local admin passwords and service accounts the right way. Get your free 30-day trial for Secret Server at runasradio.com/secret-server.
And then, of course, we can use ASMAN inside of the multipoint box for customer service and QA. So even customer service doesn't see the stuff that QA is doing because QA is seeing stuff that's probably 6 months out from what, you know, customer service needs to know about. So that's always good to know.
Mm-hmm.
Then the rule of weakest link, you know, what's kind of cool is that now we're not having to look at 20 machines and make sure and see what they're doing and what's going outbound. We have two major core systems there. Now, we're not talking, those aren't the only two machines in our network, but this is what's affected, you know, our ability to have 20 salespeople on one. We can have up to 20 QA and customer service. We don't have that many yet, but, you know, on to this other one. But what's really nice about it with the weakest link is now we're really looking in. We're eyeing in on a couple of machines, and then, of course, our security policies and our monitoring and our auditing are really being affected on certain machines. Yes, there's more auditing to do there because there's more people, but we can handle that. You know, multipoint allows you to have individualized IPs, so we can map and track everything at the firewall level and what they're doing and, mm-hmm. you know, all that kind of stuff. Then we have the rule of separation. We have physically separated those groups to allow that on there. What's interesting though is that just even though we've affected all those policy decisions, we're tracking everything that's on there. We know in the end of the day there will be times there'll be failure. There'll be times when there'll be issues. I really hate the aspect of what I call chicken little IT, which is as soon as something seems wrong, the world's falling and everyone's screaming, the world's going to come to an end.
Right.
Stop, right? And so the reality is that we want to make sure we have to understand how to deal with and respond to things as they occur in a responsible manner, while at the same time making sure that throughout the entire thing, it's not about the technology. Are we affecting proper policy? Are we affecting this meeting to the requirements? When we have someone come and say they can't do their job, we failed. We
Right.
failed to effectively do the security policies properly, because once they get a blockage and they can't work, that's affecting us business-wise.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, we got to make sure that we're looking and monitoring and tracking all that stuff. So AppLocker's huge for that. When we first rolled out, we run AppLocker in warning mode, not in enforcement mode, so that we could actually track what applications they were using and how they were using it. And then when we put the rights and locked them down, we actually knew what versions we could do. So we could say, look, we're going to allow you to run Chrome. We have to allow customer service and QA to do that because we have customers that use Chrome. But I don't want Chrome running in our corp net for our salespeople. It's just the security, the effectiveness of IE9 for us is much more in line with what we want. So salespeople must have that in there. Well, AppLocker allows us to monitor and see who was using what, when, why, and how.
Right.
And then when we put enforcement in, we were able to know what we were affecting. And there was three employees. I had to go and sit down and talk and say, look, you had in the past the ability to run Chrome in standalone mode, not installed mode. But that's not actually appropriate. That's not part of what we have acceptable here. You're going to have to take a look at IE9. And what was interesting, one of the guys came back to me and said, no, I can't. I need Chrome. Here's why. And he was able to give me some good. I was like, okay, cool. Fine. I will affect an app locker policy for your role, because in this case it happens to be a web person who needs the capabilities of using some tools for CSS that Chrome gave that IE just doesn't have effectively. And so I was able to affect a policy for his position, not for him. His position. Anybody that's in the web developer role that needs this can have that, and that policy is affected down to that level. And that's the kind of stuff that makes life easier for everybody. Because now, down the road, I know that if there's a criticality, if there's a vulnerability in Chrome, I can immediately know who has the ability to put the business at risk because of that.
Right.
Education means I'm only having to educate a few people or monitor a few accounts a little more efficiently until the vulnerability is fixed or not. Not saying that Chrome has any vulnerabilities that are at risk like that, but if it ever comes about, I'm making more effective security decisions. It's not going to affect the whole organization, only a few people.
Well, and an interesting challenge when you do get you just increased your attack surface by allowing Chrome to run for an legitimate business reason. And then you get into the situation where an exploit shows up for Chrome and you've got I think the easy reaction is, well, Chrome's got to go. Yep. And now you have to actually work through a more realistic, how exposed are we? What process could I put in place so that they can continue to use the tool, but the exploit doesn't make us vulnerable? I mean, those are a lot of thinking. It takes time to solve those things.
It does. Yeah, it's one of those things. This doesn't happen overnight, and there's no piece of software you can run that will set all this up. Mm-hmm. You need to do this based off of your understanding. And this is one of those things I think a lot of IT people don't think about, is that everyone's threat matrix will be different.
Right.
Every business has different sets of risk. Yes, there's this core of the cage rattlers. There's always going to be the malware, and there's going to be the automated attack stuff. That exists out there. But to me, that's just more of a nuisance than anything. It's really about affecting, because information security is really about what it says. Information security.
Right.
Not computer security. Not application security. Those are all different things.
Mm-hmm.
But information security is about the aspect, at the end of the day, how do we keep the data safe? How do we keep it, integral to that we can guarantee it is how we expect it to be? And so all those other things have to be decisions to make sure that we've kept those crown jewels safe. And ultimately, when we look at all the different ways that can be done, we need to be thinking from a risk perspective, what is acceptable? And I think that goes back to what I said when we started this conversation, was in the end, it's not about putting in, perfect security. It doesn't exist. It's about putting in enough security to reduce the risk to an acceptable level that everyone, all the stakeholders in business can say, you know what, we've done more than enough, and we've been responsible, and we've done the due diligence to make sure that whatever we've decided, we have an ability to say, yeah, we've reduced it to something acceptable. We don't, as an example, the firewalls on all the servers block everything except for what they're authorized to see. So if tomorrow some risk occurs, some worm that comes in that can affect some normal port, it won't affect our network in the same way.
Right.
The decision to do that means that we don't know what the threats will be in the future. The blended threats will change. We can't expect to know what we don't know,
Mm-hmm.
So ultimately, we have to do is just say it doesn't matter. And then a part of it, though, is that, that's about, preventative action. And we want to know what's going on out there to watch what's happening. But if we know in the end of the day that we can respond in a way that makes sense, in our case, every multi-point server is backed up to a Windows Storage Server Essentials box. It's one of the cool features of how multi-point works, unlike other servers. Microsoft has this other technology. You can think of it as I look at it as a glorified NAS. It's a kick butt storage solution for workstations. But they actually have built it in a way so that it will also back up multipoint server, because it treats it as a client instead of a server.
Nice.
So every single multipoint box and everything that's in there is backed up. So in my case, we have, as part of immediate and proper response, we would rather have 10 people out for an hour, tell them to go out, have coffee, and basically revert or restore that entire image in a matter of an hour and a half. Because we got full 10 gigabit ether here. So it's like, to go from the storage server back would only take us an hour, 2 hours at most, to get to a complete recovered state. So I would rather just, if we were ever at a point where we said that we have a security failure, something has occurred here, as soon as we've got a snapshot of it so we can, you know, review it and audit it later, we have to get our people back up and running.
Mm-hmm.
Well, in the case of the virtualized one, it's actually kind of easy. We have backup VMs of everything, so we could easily just detach, slam in another one, and be back up and running. But in the case of the physical one, we would just nuke it and restore from the stored server essentials box. And those kind of decisions, a lot of people are like, "Oh, wow, that's like so, you know, way too big." I'm like, no, that means my business is back up and running in 2 hours, and we can still affect and decide on what the security incidents are, review that afterwards as part of the forensics, but ultimately get people back up and doing their job.
And the preventative action one's a tricky one because it means you have to have had monitoring in place that allows you to see when exploits are coming on, or that, you know, somebody's getting better at rattling your cage than you're comfortable with.
Yeah, well, and there's a couple of things that you can do there. This is where tools actually could make this. So first off, there are tools like Microsoft's Base Security Analyzer, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which is all about looking at the baseline and saying what is acceptable, what's in there. You can affect that through huge amounts of documentation that TechNet has on how to lock down servers and do it. There is so much security infrastructure in Windows Server that is so not used. Like,
yeah,
how many people do you know actually use SDI?
It's all off by default.
Yeah, but there's a reason for it, because everyone was complaining, it's too hard, we can't affect it, we don't know what to do. Okay, fine, so they turn it all off, but it's there. What about things like NAP? You know, everyone freaks out because they're like, oh, we can't do network access protection because it's too hard, it blocks everything. I say, so don't put it in block mode. Don't put it in enforcement mode, just put it in an audit mode.
Right.
Why? Because it's going to tell you of all those things that go against the health policies of NAP. So you can be affecting and saying, oh, hey, look, that machine is not up to the patch level that we expect. That machine doesn't have the right firewall policies. That machine doesn't have the right AV signatures. That machine doesn't meet our standard policies. Well, that would be one of those things you want alarmed in your face so you can take the immediate and proper response based off of the preventative actions. You're watching for things that are not normal and taking action.
Well, it just starts with being able to surface, do we have issues? Don't interrupt work, just find out what the issues are, and then we can sort of consider how we would start moving on these things.
That's right.
I find that folks, you know, it's easier to just say, well, we can't do it, than to do that incremental process.
Yeah. It takes time, right? The investment, instead of going and spending $20,000, $30,000 in a whiz-bang thing, use that time to educate your technical staff and then have them actually affect change by doing it. And don't do it all at once. You know, do it in small chunks. Learn how to use like MBSA and actually use the baseline security analyzer to look at a desktop and see what it reports and then see, does that really affect it? When we talk about servers, things like small business server, Exchange server, SharePoint, they all have baseline analyzers that allow you to take a look for the best practice stuff. They call them the BPAs, right?
Mm-hmm.
The best practice analyzer. So it can tell you, is your Exchange server locked down to the best practices that Microsoft has? So their experts have already said, I've got a tool that will show you how to do this. How many people run that? In our office, you know, we sell, you know, password management and two-factor authentication and single sign-on solutions to small business. We get a lot of people running small business server. They don't even know that the BPA exists. And the first thing we do when we go to do an installation is we run the BPA, and we see all these problems on how they've configured the server. We say, well, before we'll install our stuff, you need to fix these things. Because we don't, you know, there's security reasons why you need to make sure that these meet up with the best practices are there. Now, some people might have actual reasons why they don't want to affect change on some of that stuff, and that's acceptable as long as they document it before we get started. Okay, so you know that these are the things.
Mm-hmm.
Same thing with the baseline security analyzer that can do that for all that stuff. There's also tools like NAP, the default NAP health policies. You can turn that on, put that in reporting mode. There is the aspect that there's lots of tools out there that can do scan analysis of ports, fingerprinting of the services. There's even tools out there, like we use two tools here. They're third party tools, but we use Nessus, which allows us to scan and look for the integrity and be able to report on any services that might be publicly exposed. And we use a combination of Nessus, Nmap, and Metasploit. And we actually have a dedicated pen test system whose job function is to run externally on a different set of nets. And we actually purposely, where we have the data center, have them rotate our IPs on a regular basis. Seems kind of odd, but the purpose for it is that that way we're not getting the standard behaviors on our internet-facing services, and then we have a mirrored image of that inside our LAN, and that allows us to scan internal, so the things that won't get through the firewall. And we can look for the behaviors and look at things, and we basically create this analysis pattern of what is acceptable and based off of everything once we've profiled it, And we run and say, okay, show me this, just the differences. What has changed since the last scan? And we run that every 14 days. Except on the public facing ones, we run that every 4 days. But what it does for us is it gives us this baseline and allows us to know there's changes. And we've actually seen it. There, as example, there was one time we did a major patch update, from Microsoft stuff, for Windows Server 2008.
Mm-hmm.
Now it wasn't R2, but, on that patch cycle, they exposed and opened up, because of the way we had locked things down, one of their patches had done something funky that disabled one of our security measures. And we were able to see all of a sudden there's port popped up that wasn't supposed to be seen from the internet side.
Right.
And we were like, ooh.
What's that?
Huh? Now let's go take a look and find out why. So then we were able to go take a look at the patches, and actually I went and talked to the patch goddess, you know, Susan Bradley, and said, hey, I got a question. You know, these patches, how does this affect? And she was able to tell me. I was like, oh, okay. So all it did is it trampled over a policy setting, and it wasn't a normal thing. So we went back to Microsoft, and we demonstrated to them what happened. They're like, oh, okay, well, this really affects, you're a corner case, you're weird, you're due security a little too tight. And I was like, well, screw you, that's my policy. So I just put the policy back in. But guess what? Our attack surface, obviously, in that case, was compromised for about, and I think in that case it was 2 days, because the scan window had hit it. It was only a 2-day window. Interestingly enough, we also, from that, learned from it. We said, okay, every time new patches come out, we need to immediately kick off a new scan in that time. So now we always scan on 1 a.m. after Patch Tuesday.
Nice. Just so you know as soon as possible what the new attack surface is.
That's right. So then we've got that. I don't care. I've tuned for silence. I only want to get reported if something's different from what the baseline was the last time we had to scan.
Right.
So that allows me to not waste my time looking at stuff I already know. Tell me what I don't know. And those kind of decisions. So Metasploit's free, we use Metasploit for testing actual vulnerabilities that exist out there. But they have a really cool, you can pay for one. They have the next for the pro version, basically, which, is really good because it actually allows you to automate these runs, sets of scans and basically pen testing of web services and applications and whatnot. Nessa, same thing. We actually pay for the professional version. So it's actually giving us, in advance of what most people get publicly in the open source world, of all the fingerprints, so that we actually are looking for the newest stuff as they know it, to affect change. And those investments, it's less money than having someone dedicated to do that kind of stuff.
Sure.
So it's worth it. But we didn't go in to buy those things till we knew what we wanted to look for first.
Right.
Because if you don't know the risk to which you're susceptible to, you can never have a secure system. So what that ultimately means is I want to assume everything gets blocked. And that only way I can do that is by understanding from least privilege, what are we going to allow them to do? Them may be people, them may be processes, services and whatnot on the service, on the systems, or product themselves. We know what Exchange needs to do. We know how we affect it. We don't want to deal with port 25 coming into our network. So we made a conscious decision to use a third party that hosts and scans and filters and deals with all of the mail traffic.
Sure.
And then we only have a single dedicated connection between our servers and their servers so that we can still get the mail. And that simple decision removed a ton of traffic coming into our network.
Yeah.
That was at risk. Lots of malware, lots of, you know, people,
yeah,
I don't know why. They like to send a lot of stuff to security companies.
I deal with it too, and it's the only way to handle it, just from a bandwidth demand perspective.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's unbelievable.
Enough, no one would have thought of that 15 years ago. Oh, yeah, we want our mail. We're going to put it into our send mailbox. I'm like, yeah, that's going to compromise you left, right, and center.
Yeah.
In those days, that was a big risk. Now it's like I've completely removed that risk. I don't have to worry about anyone banging on port 25 here.
No, we now have a specialist that we pay for, a separate organization, that's all they deal with, and we get
and
the net result from it.
That's right. Yep, that's exactly it. And that's the point. And that's one of those things that when we're talking about preventive action, is really about, you want to keep your ears to the ground. You want to know what's going on out there. But it's also about saying, look, if there's things that people can do that are better, we want to proactively assess the security in our own organization by sometimes deferring risk to other people.
Yeah.
We can defer the risk to that vendor. So we use actually a company called Exchange Defender, and that's just our choice. There's tons of them out there.
I use MailRoute.
But the value for that is that it gives us this capability that two things for us is, we're in BC, and although I love our internet providers out here, there's always an expectation that someday they might dig up another line and screw it up. The nice thing is having that outsourced to data centers that are not local here, even if we go down, our mail's still being collected. It's being scanned. It's being cleaned. As soon as we come back up, they'll get the mail dropped right away. And then they have live archive services. So that means that, you know, we can deal with this whole business contingency planning. Hey, if tomorrow the building was gone, they still can get their mail. They can connect up through Outlook Web Access 2010 and through Live Archive, see all their mail on there until it gets delivered to the Exchange server here in the office once we're back up.
Well, Dana, I think that's a show.
Cool.
We covered all 8 rules, one level or another, and definitely explore them. I hope folks go and take a look at the old blog posts and think about those things. Thanks so much for being our first guest in 2012.
Thanks. I appreciate the invitation.
And we'll talk to you next week on Run As Radio.